You look at the main kingship dynasties that most people are aware of. So everybody's aware of the Egyptian dynasty, and so that's one major effect. Obviously, the descendants of Nimrod and after Babel, where he went into Mesopotamia, into in basically the father of the Assyrians, father of the Persians. And so those dynasties grew up. And then within the Middle East, you have the Hittite dynasty, which was, disappeared, say somewhere between 1200 and 1400 BCE, depending on who you're talking to. And certainly the Philistines give them a good whooping as they expropriated their land in the Middle East. But the Mitanni dynasty was also a very familiar one. And these dynasties would intermarry to keep their bloodlines pure. And if they wanted to start a new dynasty, they had to make sure that they started it with an ennobled bloodline of a female. And so if they wanted to export a new dynasty somewhere, it would start with the matriarchy, even though everybody thinks of the patriarchy as the dominant one. You have to keep in mind that their belief system is both male and female, and it's all throughout their religions. When you look at it, whether it's Isis and Osiris, it's male and female, it's dualistic all the way through in every aspect. And so that has a very, very important. So these dynasties survived right through to the time of the Greek Empire. And even the Greeks make, and I'll cover this off in the book as well, about Alexandra being linked back to giants and the Greeks. It may be a mythology, and he may have been just a dictator that took over, but again, this whole thing dominated all of the major empires. And as these original dynasties kind of disappeared, all track through where they went to. And so if you look at the Egyptian dynasty, the last one that is of noteworthiness is the Amarna dynasty. And that's King Tut, and that's Akhenaten, and that's Skoda, and that's Nefertiti, and A, or I think as other people will pronounce it. So why was that so important is because that dynasty disappeared, and where did they go? And I'll cover that off in the end of the book, but they didn't die out, or at least their belief system says that they didn't die out. So where did they go? These bloodlines survived to repopulate the dynasties in Europe. Now, this doesn't necessarily cover off the Red Dragon dynasties of China, although you can make a case that they migrated out of the Middle East and in that direction, but there's a separate bloodline in there. I didn't follow that one because the book is long enough as it is. I kept it more for the Western side of civilization, but understand there's a very strong Red Dragon dynasty, as they call it, in Asia. And so these dynasties survived to make all of the most of the kingships that we're aware of through modern history. And most of the power being transferred back and forth would be either a Vatican-dominated kingship or from these dragon kingships. So when you look at history, look at it from a view of there's two different sides with warfare going on all of the time. And these dynasties succeeded in, for the most part, keeping their royal bloodlines on the throne all of the time. And so if you do, let's say, get a usurping of the Plantagenet that was in England, and that was by Henry VIII, and you wonder why he's so maligned. Well, he may have been a bad person, but that's not the real motive. It's because he would be coming from as an outsider, whether it's Vatican sponsored or not. And so if you look at, let's say, Shakespeare, who wrote a lot about genealogies and kingships, he is documenting these bloodlines as well, even at that time. And he is not nice on the Tudors. I mean, he takes them takes them down in his writings. And he, whether it's Richard III or whoever else, or King Lear that he's talking about, or Hamlet, he's holding those bloodlines in a completely different sort of respect level. And so these bloodlines may not have kingships dominating the world today, but these families control what goes on in the world today. We may not recognize them as kings, but some of them we will. And understand that you need to follow the King of Jerusalem title. This is the title of the Antichrist, and it's part of their bloodline legacy, and they'll declare themselves, the Antichrist will declare himself as the King of Jerusalem, and also putting in the Benjamite lines of that inheritance that Joshua had originally given back during the Exodus. And I'll cover that off in the book as well. These bloodlines have been intermixed and ennobled and tracked all the way through. They're going to use these genealogies, establish the pedigree of the Antichrist, and that he goes way back and back to these fallen giants. You have to remember, he's the Antichrist, so he's going to have a completely different pedigree than what Jesus has. But they will also, and again, if you go into literature, you're going to learn about this as well in terms of modern literature. When we talk about, let's say, the Da Vinci Code, they're going to find a way to mix in, I don't believe rightly, I don't think they can actually prove it. These will be falsified genealogies that Jesus survived, had children, and has intermarried into these bloodlines. And so they've been keeping these bloodlines purified. They keep three possible Antichrist figures indoctrinated and ready to go all of the time. And when the time is right, they will select one of these and he will step forward. So we're going to have an alien aspect to it. All depends on how they want to present it, but likely an alien aspect that we're just one of many species sitting at the galactic table, like Star Wars, like Babylon 5, like Star Trek, and that there are two sides to this war, and this side is for freedom in terms of the aliens and stuff and fighting against the evil God. Because you have to remember that these people believe that Lucifer and God are equals, and that they actually have a chance to win this. And this is an ongoing fight. So we're going to be asked to fight for our rebellion. That's going to be this underlying tone. So there's going to be an alien involvement. And even if we look at some of prophecy, we read in Daniel and Revelation where this war reaches into the heavens. And so that's a bit allegorical, but I think that's a reference that there's an alien presence that's going to be utilized in that. We also have to understand that the fallen angels are going to be released in the end days out of the abyss. So that's going to be an aspect in terms of Nephilim and how they work with possible aliens and the governments and the secret societies and all these other things going on. So all of this is coming together. We can see that coming together, I think. But if we look from history, whether we look at prehistory or Babel, we saw that there was the universal religion. And so that should come together first. And the false prophet will stem out of that. So whether we're talking about Enoch, son of Cain, not of Seth, and people need to understand there were two Enochs in prehistory, and they were not the same, and there are different books surviving written by each, that there is that as a false prophet, and the potentates through the Nephilim that came along, just like we'll have descendants of Nephilim and potentates that are going to form world government, but you have to have the universal religion first, in my opinion. And just like at Babel, we had Hermes. He was the false prophet that was going, that was leading the universal religion there. So we have to have the universal church. Then we have to have the false prophet that will lead to, because of the power of the universal religion, to 10 empires being set up. Just as Daniel talks about, just as the Club of Rome has planned, that's their job to bring about these 10 empires. And I look at those as trading blocks, economic zones, powers of influence, not separate countries, as so many prophetic people have looked at in the past. So they'll have 10 different empires in the world that form this world government. And it will be the Antichrist that negotiates this world treaty. He won't be totally known. Christians will recognize him as the Antichrist, but he won't be crowned Antichrist until halfway through the end time. And so there's a distinct order of how this needs to have happen. And I know it's difficult to believe that there'll be universal religion, but, that's what Revelation tells us. and that the Antichrist is going to rise that quickly to power, and he's not going to have to do it by war. He's just going to usurp at the middle of the tribulation three of those empires and expect those to be the Western democracies, in my opinion, because he's going to distribute the plunder, which is another word for wealth distribution. And so all of this has played out in the past, and that's why I have one of the chapters that are that is named as a transition from the old part of the history of the Nephilim into modern times. Nothing new is under the sun. We've seen this before. We're going to see it again. So we're going to see an ever-growing movement to bring down borders and attacks against nationalism, Christians, and monotheists being slowly set aside as the mundane, the people that will not be permitted to join the New Age because we're not worthy and we're incapable of evolving. This will only be reserved for what they would say, some people might say is the RH bloodline, but they also refer to it as the gene of ISIS, that there's a particular gene, what they believe that they have. These will be the people that will take over their New Age, not the regular people, and it's usually the rich. So, and look for it to come together through, you know, the slow movement of the negotiation of free trade treaties, technology, but then, as with all prophecy, in my opinion, is for it to happen very quickly in short steps with cataclysmic events. So you can imagine an economic disaster or other disasters that will unite humankind, nuclear war, but there'll be something that comes along that speeds the process up in a very short period of time.